Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 99. My name is Charles Lowell, developer here at the Frontside and your podcast host in training. And with me today is Mr. Taras Mankowski. Welcome.
Thank you, Charles. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So, I mean, you are ubiquitous in the JavaScript world. You do a lot of stuff with mentoring, and a lot of you, you know, are involved in a bunch of different interesting projects. I think you're one of those developers who's difficult to classify, which is, you know, that's definitely one of my favorite kind of developers. I wanted to have you on the show today because there's been a project that we've been collaborating on, and there've been, you know, some interesting ideas to have, you know, come out of that and kind of solidify through that project, at least in my head. And yeah, I thought we could maybe just kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sounds good. It's going to be fun.
The thing that we are going to be talking about is a project called Funkadelic. It's more than really just a library, a JavaScript library on GitHub. It's kind of a different way of thinking about your code. And so I know, you know, for me, where this really became part of my workflow was, when was it? It was about like, what, 3 months ago, something like that, 6 months ago?
Oh, I think, yeah, I think it's probably more 6 months ago. I think it's probably about 2 months, I think probably December, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But I mean, it's hard now to imagine working without this tool on my workbench. It's been probably the biggest game changer for me in the last, I don't know, definitely in the last several years.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive how little, how small of a library can have such a big impact, you know, in what we do day to day. Because it definitely makes me think differently about how I can solve problems that I solve on a daily basis when I work with React. Mm-hmm. So it's been pretty interesting. I think for me, like having worked with this library, I think what I'm getting is an understanding of how things work in a way, and a perspective on how React works in a way that I don't think wasn't available to me before using Funkadelic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The funny thing is, it's not a React library, right? So it's not the fact that it's not designed for React. It's just
I don't even think that it helps you think about React, but I don't even think it's the way that the React developers think about React, right?
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think a lot of people are on the spectrum of understanding like functional programming, and I think a lot of people people learn how to use React, but they don't really. I don't think a lot of people have traveled very far. I'm talking about general, like majority. There's definitely people who know functional programming really well, and there's a lot of really good libraries in JavaScript space for doing functional programming in JavaScript. But I don't think the general public, the general, you know, people that, you know, on a daily basis go into, you know, write a render function and do like, you know, this dot or like product dot map and then map and return an array of components. Like, I don't mm-hmm. think those people necessarily think about or, you know, get kind of the context within which they use this tool.
You know, right. And I think that's actually one of the reasons I think a library like Funkadelic is so important and fills kind of a missing piece in the ecosystem is because it really is predicated on the idea that programmers use these concepts all the time. They really are, you know, they're foundational. But we only kind of see them out of the corner of our eye in our peripheral vision as being like a formal concept, like mapping and giving a name to that. You know what I mean? Like you do the mapping, but you're not thinking about how do I generalize over it? And I think that for me, certainly like in my journey with like functional programming, I thought that it was mostly about functions. Not to say that it isn't, but that was kind of the end of the story. It's like keep your functions pure so that the outputs are only dependent on the inputs and, you know, away you go. Like and understand closures and higher order like functions that, you know, functions that return functions or take functions and like that's it. But, you know, I really feel kind of that's only half the story.
Part of it, I think, is that for people, even like if you look at the kind of content that's available around functional programming, it tends to be, you know, trying to kind of bridge people into this idea of thinking of, you know, map, filter, reduce kind of operations. And I think that, like, I mean, that's a place that I think where everybody starts. But I think what happens is that you really are missing, and I think it's for most people. And it wasn't for me. Like, it wasn't until you wrote the README for Funkadelic, and then I read it. Like, I, you know, up until that point, I didn't really, I was also the same. Like, I didn't know how these things were related to each other, right? Because there's this like history and wealth of conceptual like depth that connects all these things together, and these things are well understood by people who don't, you know, they're probably not writing JavaScript on a daily basis, mm-hmm. right? Like, they might be like Haskell programmers or Lisp programmers, or, you know, ClojureScript or something, like in other worlds, not like JavaScript world. And so there is all this understanding about how functional programming works, but I don't think it's really leaked to the general masses of the JavaScript community.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't until I started reading, like, the README, I'm like, there's so many answered questions that I don't even know these questions were asked, you know?
No. And I think you're absolutely right. It isn't accessible to the general, like, JavaScript community. And part of that is because one person's, like, when you read about these things, when I would go read about these kind of higher order concepts, you know, of basically classifying functions, not just so of saying, like, yeah, what is the essence of a map operation? What's the essence of an apply operation? You know, what's the essence of concatenation? Things like that. You know, I go read the documentation in, like, Haskell or in Clojure, and, you know, first of all, even it's hard to distinguish when you're not programming those day to day. Am I reading reference documentation or, like, explanatory documentation? But even in the explanatory documentation, you know, they're using what seems like incredibly, like, self-referential and abstract examples. And I don't think that's necessarily a knock against those communities. I think what it is what's concrete to one person is abstract to another. It's like, if you're working with those things, if you're working with those sets of analogies, and then those, you're working with those abstractions every day, then they're concrete to you in a sense that, like, once it, like, clicks in your mind and your mind kind of accepts it and rationalizes over it, then it moves from being, yes, it's an abstraction, but it's a concrete abstraction in the sense that you can have a conversation with somebody and use that abstraction as an example, as a counterpoint and a method to triangulate and reveal other abstractions. But if you're talking to somebody for whom those abstractions haven't clicked yet, you know, then it's opaque and it's not helpful. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that I realized is, like, we are using these abstractions, we just don't have names for them. And so, you know, I wanted to give them names and put them in the hands. And the names are weird, but they are really useful. And so, yeah, maybe we could, like, talk about some of those right now, because I think that, you know, maybe now's a good time to, like, actually introduce some of those abstractions. So, for example, if you don't know what a functor is, it is, like, worthless to talk about a monad, in my opinion. So, you know, that was, like, a critical piece of information for me, because that is, like, missing in every monad tutorial you ever read. At least, like, you know, I must have read 1,000 monad tutorials, and very, like, they kind of, like, glossed over functor or didn't mention it, whatever. Maybe they did, but, like, I wasn't looking. And, like, that needs to be put front and center, that there is a natural sequence to these things. It's like some of these abstractions are built on other abstractions, and you have to, like, you can't skip to monad. You have to start with functor. Again, I realize that's probably gibberish gobbledygook to a lot of people. So it really, you know, this is what Funkadelic is about. What this conversation's about is just saying, like, kind of talking through it in real world examples to, like, make those abstractions concrete. So it doesn't feel strange and anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely giving names to things. I think it's really helpful. One thing I really like about Funkadelic is that you're not giving names that you made up. Like, these are names that, you know, existed for 50 years, right? They're mm-hmm. they're, like, historic. And so when you talk to somebody who is familiar with functional programming, and if you say functor, like, all of a sudden, like, I feel much smarter, and you know, and we're actually referencing to the same thing, because alternatively, like, you can say something like, you know, something that is mappable, right? Like, a functor is essentially describes something that you can map over,
right? And that's all it is,
right? And but, you know, having a name for it, you know, it allows you to, you know, just describe it exactly as it is.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I mean, and there are tons of things that you can map over, right? Like most of the time we think about arrays, right? It's like something that we can map over.
So one thing I found really interesting in starting to use Funkadelic is that when you start thinking about things as their like abilities, right? Like you know that with an array you can map over an array is something we've all been doing for a while, but then when something that you end up doing a lot of when you get familiar with an array, being able to use object map, like mapping an object, becomes mm-hmm. something you want to do at some point. But
right.
Most of the time what happens is that you're like, oh, I don't actually like, well, I have to write this thing. Like, how do I write this thing? And then, okay. And then by the time you do this, you're like, okay, I'm just going to go to Lodash and I'll just get the map thing that will do, you know, they'll map an object. At the end of the day, it doesn't quite necessarily feel right because a lot of these libraries like Lodash has map, but it feels like there is always some kind of a compromise, like with how these things are implemented. Like it's not consistent.
Right.
And I don't remember exactly what the problem with Lodash map was. I think I know for a fact there are like there's different ways that you can map things. There's different functions available for mapping different things in Lodash.
There's like map to and it map in and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, all these different variations, you know, but I think it's been really interesting. Like, you know, we've been using Funkadelic on, you know, on the project we've been working on Microstates, and just being able to use one function map that is going to map an array or is going to map an object, and it's going to do it the same, use the same yeah. function, and it's going to do the same thing.
Yeah, you have one function that like maps over the values. And that's the thing is like, you know, you realize you can map over an arrays, you can map over objects, you can map over observables, you can map over promises, you can map over, you know, trees, you can map, like there's literally thousands of things that you can map over. It's the same, and like realizing that all of these fragmented interfaces can be coalesced into a single interface. And so it really is, it's, I think the biggest thing is that like the power of polymorphism for a function, right? Because that's basically the problem that I think, I think it is a problem that a lot of the functional programming libraries suffer from, is that the only polymorphism is object polymorphism, which is kind of the native polymorphism in JavaScript. Whereas, you know, in systems like Haskell and like Clojure, you can have a function be polymorphic, right? And so one function can operate on many different kinds of data, provided it has, you know, an interface. So like when we're working in microstates, we use literally one function, map, like the actual same function, the reference to the same function we use everywhere when we map. And we're just mapping a bunch of different things. So I think that that's one of the reasons that I prefer Ramda, for example, over Lodash, is because it has a form of polymorphism. Most of the things like maps and lenses and, you know, applicatives and stuff, they work on both, almost everything works on both objects and arrays, right? So that's actually kind of nice. So Ramda has a basic polymorphism. But I think one of the other things that is like really empowering about Funkadelic is that it allows you to make the map function work on any data structure that you happen to come up with, like anything that you want. You can make it mappable and map will work on it.
Yeah, I think for people, it's probably quite abstract, like what that actually looks like. I think one thing that's interesting is that, like the way, so, you know, for listeners, like the way that would look is you have a class, so you have like ES6 class, which gives name to a certain piece of data that you have in your application. And then what you can do with Funkadelic, you can then say, this is how you would implement, like if you were to map this kind of an object, you know, if you had an instance of this object, if you wanted to map that object, you can specify like what is the function that you would use. So even though you would use the same, like, you would import map from Funkadelic and you would use that map to map whatever that object is and whatever type it is. But you there's a way for you to say, for instances of this type, I would like to use this specific implementation of a map to map that object, but use one function to do it. So you use one function that you call, but you can specify under the hood, you can specify like how the actual, what is actually used to map that instance.
Right. And then that's nice because then you can, you know, anything that uses a mappable object, there's a couple reasons that that's nice, right? Is, you know, anytime you can have some sort of higher order mechanism that just requires that something be mappable, that it be a functor. And then it's really nice because then you can have kind of higher order operations that they just need something that's like mappable, but you don't have to kind of use that one shot of like actually having a map function as a property of the object, which is, you know, you can actually, if you can kind of define like wrapper classes or whatever that then introduce a unique way that this object can be mapped. So you can have the same structure and map it three different ways. Whereas you're kind of constrained by that using normal OO inheritance because you have to have a map property on your object.
Yeah, there's something else actually when you start thinking about this. Like for me personally, I think the first step, you know, when we start working with objects, you know, having mappable objects was like a kind of first thing that was really like really helpful. But then I think really quickly, right after that, I think my second thing that I start using, and I think it's probably my favorite feature now, is append. I think it's So append is a implementation of a semigroup, but I think it's simpler. Like a simplest metaphor would be something like object assign, right? So an object assign is an implementation of a semigroup, except that object assign is mutates the object that you pass into it. It doesn't, right? It doesn't create a new object for you.
Right. So again, like getting to this idea that there are some universal operations, like there's this idea that you can take two things. I don't want to say object because that's an actual concrete type in JavaScript, two things, and you can smush them together. And I think there was actually, wasn't there literally a big controversy about this, about like array smush? I think this is nice smushing, right? But you can smush things together. And with addition, I can smush two integers together or two numbers together and get a third number, right? Or with objects, I can take two objects and smush them together by merging their keys. Or I can take two strings and I can smush them together and I can get, end up with a string that's concatenated. Or I can take two arrays and smush them together and I've got, you know, now an array that's been concatenated. So what's interesting is these are all very, very different types that I've just described, and yet there is some fundamental operation about them. And I think this is actually something that's bad about JavaScript is there's like five different names for all those operations that we talked about, but it's really one unifying concept. And that might seem like a small thing, but when you have five different interfaces for one fundamental construct, that leads to like fragmentation and you can't treat that data uniformly. And it ends up for like paper cuts everywhere. Whereas if you can unify all of these into a small, like one thing, which is like, we can append two objects and then we're going to have an implementation of append for array. And we're called, you know, and behind the scenes, it's going to call smush. And we've got a implementation of append for object, which is going to like assign the keys in an immutable way and return a new object. Or we're going to have a implementation of append for string, which is going to concatenate the strings. You might even, I don't know, like a hardcore like FP nerd would have to probably correct me because this is just totally a conjecture, although I know it's probably a solved problem, is maybe you could say like we append two functions together and that returns a function which is composed, right? That might be a way that you could say, well, what would it look like? Is function a semigroup? Like, can we append two functions together? And maybe you end up with like a pipe or function composition or something like that. But I think that highlights when you have these universal interfaces, because literally in I feel like most of the stuff that we like have been working with, there's like five interfaces, and like everything is one of these five interfaces, and it kind of flips you on your head because kind of the classic programming wisdom that I have certainly espoused for at least the last 10 years is that you don't want to like race to find abstractions. Like that's dangerous because you can get locked into the wrong abstraction, right? Wait, let the abstraction emerge. And I'm a lot less bullish on that concept now that I've kind of discovered these things, because that wisdom is cultivated in a world where there are billions of abstractions, if you're giving unique names to everything and the combinations between them. But if you are coming up in a world where there's five basic abstractions, right, then it actually pays off to ask the question, is this thing a functor? Is it a semigroup? Is it a monad? What would that look like? It's a nice thought experiment that doesn't require that much investment. You can think about it for a couple of minutes, and usually you can come up and say, yes, yes, it totally is, and I can start using it. And now I've like introduced this really powerful abstraction. Or you say like, no, no, it's not. And then that information is just as valuable. And so it's very low cost to experiment with abstractions. And so I kind of think of it as, I know I'm like on a little bit of a rant here, but this has kind of been a major revelation for me, is that, you know, when you have very few abstractions, which you compose in, you know, myriad ways versus having a whole bunch of abstractions that can't be composed very much, the cost for experimenting with abstraction and making the, you know, raw extraction is like several orders of magnitude lower. And so you don't have to be as cautious, and you can actually use like trying on abstractions as a tool rather than a very, very high risky undertaking. And like, just to kind of close that thought out, I think that I don't know if anybody else but me like remembers the world before we decided like we were going to make all of our web services RESTful. Like when people first started like building all these web services, we were just like going crazy with the endpoints, and there was like no rhyme or reason, like, you know, kind of weird arbitrary levels of nesting. Sometimes you'd throw in an ID as a query param. Sometimes you'd throw it in as part of the path. And then I definitely remember it was probably around, I don't know, 2010 for me, where, you know, I listened to a podcast where James Edward Gray was talking about S3 and was it a RESTful interface, and like this, the O'Reilly book, and it really clicked for me, and realizing that if you constrain yourself to like thinking about your API at least as this fundamental operation of manipulating resources, and there's like, you were constrained to four verbs, and everything you want to have ID like based URLs and resources and as flat as possible, like those constraints actually are very enabling for consumers over your API and for like actually authoring an API. And I think it's the same principle at work here. Anyway, so I'll end that rant.
Yeah, I think people could probably, for those who haven't been in programming as long as Charles been, you know, it's probably easier to, Charles, I think it's probably, people could probably relate to like what's happening with components now, I would imagine, because having components essentially look the same across every framework, you know, they all have props and they all render, you know, return some DOM or some variation of that, but it's kind of the same thing. You take some data and then you return something that is going to become DOM. And I think having that as a rule for like what a component is, you can make really complicated applications using these kind of fundamental building blocks. You know, and then you don't have to, like, there's not really much thinking on like, well, how am I, what interface is this component going to have? Like, okay, well, you know, it's going to accept props, and you know, it's going to render some DOM when you actually render it, right? That simplicity, I think, is really helpful. And I think it's one of the things that you know, I think one of the things about Funkadelic that I really like is like there's like kind of a really small set of rules that are really helpful, and these rules are actually, they make it predictable, because one thing that I find really challenging with, you know, with using like Lodash or using Ramda is that because there's so many functions, it's difficult to know like what is actually going to happen when I do something. So like, you know, a good example would be like, you know, if you use omit from Lodash, like Lodash omit, well, then it will actually, one thing you can do is you could like materialize your getters. So like if you have getters in your object, those getters could become values on the new object that's created. You know, so like that's one thing that could happen. Or if you use omit, like your symbol, so like if you have values,
what does omit do, by the way? I'm actually,
omit is a pretty popular way to exclude functions. So it'd be basically like a filter equivalent of for an object. You know, so it's usually used to remove some props from you know, the props that are coming into a component.
Right,
But
right.
it can do some, like, you know, but it can actually change the type of the object. Like, one thing you know for sure is if you do use something like emit, or if you use a sign, if you have an instance of something, guaranteed, you know, working with that object in an immutable way is going to cause some really strange things. Like, I think with emit, if you were to have an instance, like, it would definitely not give you an instance of the same type, like an object of the same type. It will give you just a regular POJO. And there is no real way. I mean, you could create an instance. I don't know what a sign would do. I'm guessing that it would just take an instance, it would put things on it. But it's really not, like, I think this kind of ambiguity doesn't work very well when you're trying to build something, when you really just need to know that exactly how your tool behaves. I think that's one thing that, you know, with Funkadelic, because it's such a small API, and because you know for a fact that the library is designed to be immutable, and it's designed to preserve type information. And you know that if you use one of the operations, you will get most likely the same kind of object, and you're not, well, you will get the same kind of object, and you're not going to, it's not going to mutate that object. And, you know, so there's some of these guarantees are actually really helpful, and in many ways liberating, I think, for when you, especially when you're trying to do more challenging things, not like trivial, like just copy one object, you know, copy some properties from one object to another, but when you're actually doing more sophisticated things, you know, in those use cases, having these kind of rules is extremely powerful.
No, and I've definitely resisted, and I think we'll continue to, resist trying expanding the API surface area that much. Because it is, I think there's only like five or six functions in there, but what you get for those functions is, extremely powerful and extremely predictable. I think it might help to give like a concrete example, like when you were talking about like object assignment. Like if you have like a car class in your application, and you want to do like an immutable object assign, well, the kind of the stereotypical way to do that, or the typical way to do that, is you create an empty object. And then you like assign one car to it, and then you assign the next car to it. And now you've merged these two car things, right? But then the problem is you're going to get an object out of that, not a car. It's just going to be a vanilla object. Now it's going to have all the properties of both, but it's not going to be a car. And that could be a problem if you've got any custom methods on the prototype, any computed properties on the prototype. It's going to be a problem. Whereas Funkadelic, you can append two cars together. And you're going to know that it's going to have both of the properties. You're going to know that it's going to be of type car. And you don't have to worry about like running the constructor or anything like that. It's just going to have the properties are going to be carried over like properly. If you're using a library like a Lodash or Ramda or something that doesn't account for type, because you, in order to append two things or map something, the implementation actually lives with the type, not with the function. The function is polymorphic, but the implementation lives with the type. You can then actually, you can always return the proper type, because it's ultimate. Like if your map operation or your filter operation or your what have you operation doesn't take type into account, then there's no way to actually preserve type. But like because we delegate in Funkadelic, it's core to the concept, and so it's actually a very trivial thing to do, which is why you get that repeatability.
One of my favorite things about append and so semigroup implementation for object is that, well, you can overload getters on an existing instance, and so what you'll get is you get a new instance with the getter that you pass to append applied to that instance. And this is kind of trippy, but it's actually really powerful because, so let's say you have an instance of an object, and that instance has some getters on it. And so we, and those getters use some properties of this object to compute their value. And so when you want, when, like if I need to create a copy of that object in such a way that the getters still continue to work properly, but I need to overwrite like how one specific getter works for one specific instance, like one specific scenario, one specific use case in my code, then I can just use append. So the first argument is the original instance, second argument is an object that has the getters that I want, that I want to be to overload the getters on the original object. And then append will squish those things together, smoosh those things together, and give me a new instance that has the getters that I passed in the second argument, and all the same things that the first object had, and that object will work. It will just, like, this new object will be fully functional object, just like the previous the original right. object that I still have a copy of that I can use. But this is really interesting because like one thing that I'm finding with having these kind of tools in my tool set is that I've had features that I needed to implement on a project, and you know, the people that I work with are really technical, so they know like where problems are going to be, you know, and so they, you know, they would like write requirements for like how something, you know, for a feature that needs to be implemented, and like knowing the problems, they're like, oh, by the way, you're going to have a problem in this area, you know, when implementing this kind of specific functionality. And but for me, I'm like, well, having this tool set, I'm like, I don't see this problem at all, because you know, like it's so easy for me, because I know that if I need to implement, like, you know, so if I have something that has expected behavior, but I need to create something that behaves very similarly, slightly different in one particular use case, I can always just copy that object and then overload its behavior, and it's still going to be a fully functional object. And I think that alone is just not, it's not something that you can do usually, you know, it's not something that's available.
Yeah. It's a technique that I think was discovered, like maybe it's not original to us, but it's just the tools enabled it in the sense that it's like, you know, it's like having a flashlight in a dark room. It's like that technique was always there. It's just when it becomes so concise that it's so easy to just, you know, append one computed property to a thing, then you just wouldn't have thought to do it otherwise.
Well, what's interesting about this too, for me, is that, and this is kind of goes back to the context conversation that we had earlier, is that I think React brought into our lives functional programming kind of in a big way, because part of programming React applications is, you know, working with functional components and working with functional concepts. And a lot of the things like, you know, Redux, like a lot of these things are powered by functional programming, and they work together. They compose well together because they're all from the same paradigm. But the problem is that there's all these concepts developed together over time, and they've been tested together, and they've been kind of formulated together in languages like like Haskell. But the ideas that make all of this stuff work really well together, they haven't really become available in JavaScript community. And it feels like it's like we are all using a language that we don't fully understand, you know, it's like, you know, and we don't like, it's like we're all a lot of people in JavaScript world when it comes to functional programming, it's kind of like being, you know, having English as a second language. It's like, you know, you can use the words, but you don't understand the humor, you know, and it's kind of like, oh, you can't make a joke. You know, it's kind of like that. You can't really express yourself correctly when you don't have full grasp of the language. And I feel like how we use functional programming in JavaScript is a little bit like that. And by thinking about, by starting to like bring these ideas, like moving the wealth of knowledge from the source into the realm where we actually need to use it now, we can actually start to take it, like leverage these, all these insight that actually enables all of this. So it's not like, so the idea of how to write React and think in a reactive way or think in a functional way, like those things are not just owned by the React core team, or they're not owned by like a group of developers who really understand how functional programming works. It's like, it's just available to everyone. And all you need to do is just like, you know, learn some of these concepts that glue all these ideas together that are fundamental pieces of like how functional programming works.
Right. That's a great point, and points back to kind of the original reason that I wrote Funkadelic and then, you know, started and then continued work on it with you, is that, you know, it started out as an educational exercise. You know, what would these things look like if they were translated into JavaScript? And it turned out that it rapidly became core to my workflow and way of thinking. And so it really is, there is weird names to these universal concepts. It is true. It is a foreign language. I really like that analogy. But, you know, foreign languages sound weird. And when people are talking in a foreign language, you know, you can feel excluded. And the really like the reason that we wrote Funkadelic and the reason it's there is to make them accessible, these things accessible to you, so that those abstract foreign words can over time turn into concrete concepts that you're completely comfortable with. Just like any word in any language, at some point you approached it having no idea what that sound represented. And so it really is trying to the emphasis there is not to noodle about and dwell on the names of the concepts, but to take the real things that you are actually doing, give them names and formalize them to enable you to participate in this like new functional world that you're describing. Because you're, I love that sentiment. It does not belong to the React core team. It doesn't belong to an elite set of, you know, developers on this project or that project. It literally is a universal tool that is 100% achievable, and people don't even realize how close, you know, if they've been working with JavaScript for, you know, a couple of years, like how close like they actually are.
Yeah, I think they're really like, I think for most people, if they're to read the README, and then, well, I think one of the problems, I think it kind of works with the language metaphor, is that you need an immersion, right? I think one of the reasons why like Funkadelic really stuck for, and you know, functors and semigroups and filterable and you know, all of these things really stuck for me, you know, and I'm thinking about how, you know, using monads and, you know, monadic operations, all the applicatives and all this stuff. Like the reason why it all stuck for me is because, you know, I've been able to talk to you about it. I think for people, finding a network that would allow them to practice the, you know, immersively think about functional programming, not just like, you know, occasionally. I mean, you could do it occasionally as well. It just takes much longer, right? But
yeah,
once you have a few conversations where you try to dissect the problem in a functional way, and you think about, you know, what are these pieces are made of, like it becomes very natural very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really great point. And the thing is, you can immerse yourself incrementally. So you can just say, you know what, I'm just going to start using append. Anywhere that I can cat to strings, or I could cat to arrays, or I would do object assign. I mean, screw that. You can even just say, instead of using object.assign, I'm going to use append and start there. Or to say, I'm just going to start with mapping. You don't have like, so that, I think also the thing that's nice about it too, is the buy-in can be incremental, but you're right. You do need immersion. You do need practice. You need to actually use the functions, and you need to be able to use them one at a time so that your mind can close over them, so that you can kind of move on to the next one.
Yeah.
So that might be one way, is to say like, I don't think I really understood. I was already using append and map ubiquitously before I really understood like, applicative, apply, right? So you don't have to grok it all at once. Like you can definitely bite it in chunks. And the best way to do that is to start with one concept and really just attack it mercilessly. And then also understand that there's a natural sequence there.
I would add a bit of a caveat to that is that I think there's a thing about doing something for learning purposes. Mm-hmm. And there's another thing about shipping things. What's interesting with Funkadelic, and what's interesting about a lot of these ideas from functional programming, is that I think they give you benefits that you might have not previously thought. Like, for example, if you're going to concat two strings together, doing it with append is probably a most verbose way of doing it, relative to like, you know, just being able to use
That's true. You would want to use a string template, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but there's areas when using like. There's times when things are just not possible otherwise. So like, for example, if you wanted to treat an instance of a class in an immutable way, this is simply not possible in any way. So like, if you're going to say, I'm going to work with a bunch of these, I'm going to work with a bunch of these instances of the ES6 type, and I want to keep them as instances because they have certain behaviors that I want to have. Like, I want to have a getter on it, or I want to have a method on it, and I want to keep these things fully, like full instances, like not broken, like not be turned into objects. I want it to be normal instances, but I want to work with them immutably. when I need to make a change, I want to get a new object and not modify that object. So if you set yourself that goal and you say, this is what I'm going to do, then you really don't, are not left with very, very many options. You only really have, like, you have to use Append from Funkadelic. And because alternatively, you're going to implement something yourself, and you might as well just use Append. Right. And I think that's a good place. Like, I think if you're starting to, you know, if you need to make something lazy, you know, if you need to delay an execution of something, so instead of pushing that execution, like, not instead of using object assign and then computing everything ahead of time, you can use Append and you can create a getter, and you can, you know, delay the computation of that value until the point when the user actually reaches for that value. Like, if you want to start doing that kind of stuff, like, you really are not left with very, very, very many options, and Append is, like, the way to do it. And but that's, I think, is, like, when you start to set these kind of standards for yourself, you level up in a way that is very kind of significant. You know, it's like, I think it's just a kind of natural progression of learning. It's like, you know, you start off learning, you're like, you know, anything goes. Like, as long as you can make this website work, it's like, I'm happy. And then over time, you get better and better at it. And then when you get good at building applications, you, like, the next step might be like, oh, well, what if I was stricter about it? Like, what if I could actually, like, what would that open up for me? What would that allow me to do? I personally think about it that way.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. You mentioned having a network for discussing these concepts and trying to internalize them. You know, let me first and foremost, like, offer myself as somebody, if this is a hill that you are interested in climbing, and I think it is a very worthwhile hill to climb because of the perspective that you will gain from its summit, please reach out to me. You can contact me at CowboyD on Twitter or CowboyD@frontside.io. I'd be happy to discuss these kinds of things, because I think that these tools are just incredibly powerful and will improve you. So if folks want to get in touch with you, Taras, where would that be?
I'm TarasM @gmail.com and TarasM on Twitter.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. And as always, if you want to get in contact with us at Frontside, you can just email us at contact@frontside.io or give us a shout on Twitter at @thefrontside. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you all next time for episode 100. Thank you.